Many of us are terrified of losing our ability to remember things. We freak out when our memories fail us. Lost keys, the name on the tip of your tongue that just won't come to mind, or forgetting an appointment. But I'm happy to be able to tell you, you should stop worrying about those lapses because science. I would love you, though, to tell us how you remember things you need to do. Hit us with your strategies. Post-it notes, string on your finger, perhaps something a bit more high tech. We'd love to hear how you defeat that tendency of our brains to let things slip. Lisa Genova is with us today. She's a best-selling author and a neuroscientist. You might know her book, Still Alice. The movie version starred Julianne Moore. Well, Lisa's newest book is called Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. Lisa, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Now, your books up until now have been fictional accounts of people living with different neurological diseases. What prompted you to write a book just about the facts?
So I've been talking about Alzheimer's to audiences all over the world for about a decade, using Still Alice as a vehicle for that conversation. And while the conversation always began with Alzheimer's, it always migrated to forgetting and memory in general. And what I found is that, you know, folks would approach me in the book signing line or in the ladies' room, and these would be folks usually in their 50s, 60s, 70s, who are as if confessing something to me, telling me, you know, they keep forgetting people's names and they have to write things down or they won't remember to do them later or they can't remember why they walked into a room. And does this mean, and they're panicked, and does this mean that I have Alzheimer's or I'm about to get Alzheimer's? And the good news that I can tell everyone is, no, none of those things mean that you're getting Alzheimer's. These are all normal episodes of forgetting that happen because you own a normal human brain. And so I was giving folks this education and this massive relief one person at a time in a ladies' room. And so I thought, you know, it's really probably time for me to write this down in a book and be more efficient about educating people on a larger scale.
Well, then men can read it too. That would be useful, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, it is such a relief to know that, you know, that moment when you step across the threshold and everything you were thinking before you left the kitchen is gone, that is fine. What was the reason, though, Lisa, that you were drawn to study the brain and memory in the first place?
So I was always interested in biology, sort of, you know, how we're built and how we work. And in college, I took my first course in what would now be called neuroscience, but I'm old enough that at the time it was called biological psychology or physiological psychology. And that course really lit me up. I got so passionate about the brain and how that works. It's so different from all of the other organs in our body, because here is a biological tissue that is the seat of how we think and remember and desire and walk and talk. And it's amazing to me. And at about the same time, I also read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks.
Oh, yes.
And so, yeah. And so just really not just the biology. And, you know, I did study the molecular biology of the brain when I was in graduate school, but understanding the lived human experience of the result of all of those neurons. So really like the human condition combined with the neurological condition.
Well, and it's so lovely hearing the enthusiasm in your voice, Lisa. And I got really excited reading different parts of your book, Remember, particularly the idea that our brain's capacity for memory appears to be limitless. Tell us a little bit about where and how memories are made and stored in the brain.
Okay, so memory, there are different kinds of memory and they're made and stored in different ways. So we have memories for the stuff you know. So that's, you know, all of the, that's the Wikipedia of your brain. You have memories for the stuff that happened. So this is your personal history. This is the when, remember when. You have memory for how to do things. So we call it muscle memory, but the memory doesn't reside in your muscles. It resides in your brain. So this is everything from how you brush your teeth and type an email and drive your car and ride a bike. That's a memory. There's also memory for what you plan to do later. So these are all slightly different, but for memories that are consciously held that last longer than the present moment, the first necessary ingredient you need to form that memory is attention. So the first step in memory formation is encoding the sights and sounds and smells and emotion and meaning behind what you have experienced and noticed and paid attention to into neurological language. But we don't capture everything. So, you know, your eyes are open for business, you know, maybe 16 hours a day, and you won't remember most of what your brain saw. You'll only have a chance to remember what you paid attention to. So for a lot of us, this actually explains why those keys go missing and you can't find your glasses or your phone or remember where you parked your car. This isn't actually a memory problem when those go missing. This is actually a symptom probably of distraction. You never paid attention to where you put them in the first place. And so that very first step of memory formation never even got started. So what you pay attention to can then be brought to a part of your brain called the hippocampus. The hippocampus is the structure in your brain that is the little engine that consolidates all of that information into a lasting memory. And what I mean by that is, you know, the sights and the sounds and the smells and the emotion of something that happened had previously maybe had nothing to do with each other. They're all distinctly separate things, but they become bound together in a neurological circuit that's connected neurobiologically through connections in your brain. And when one part gets activated in the future, you can retrieve the whole memory. So it's what you pay attention to, then it's how those neurons become connected, and then later on how you're able to retrieve them through activation of one part, it will light up the whole circuit.
That was really lovely reading about what happens when in a brain when you look at it in an MRI when someone's trying to remember something. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if we have you in a functional MRI right now and I ask you to look at a photograph, and so say I have you look at a photo of Mickey Mouse. And so you're looking at a photo of Mickey Mouse and we can see the parts of your brain that are lighting up. And then if I take the photo away and maybe a few minutes go by, I ask you to remember that photograph of Mickey Mouse. You might at first, the imaging, the brain scan might show your brain looking around at first, like different parts of your brain are sort of flitting around and lighting up, but then it lands in a particular pattern. And that will be the same pattern that was lit up when you were actually looking at Mickey Mouse. And it is at that point where you'll say, I've got it. I remember him.
That's really interesting because I guess a lot of people like me thought that there was some particular place in your brain where our memories were stored, the little memory vault, but no.
Right. That's a common misconception, right? There's no memory bank. It's not like a file cabinet. Your memory is not a video camera recording a constant stream of every sight and sound you're exposed to and then locking it away in one particular corner of your brain. It's, you know, sight and sound are actually like that. They have real estate in particular places in your head. But memory is not. Memory is the neural connections that can be very disparate. So, you know, the sound of Mickey Mouse is located in a different part of your brain as the sight, the visual image of Mickey Mouse. But those two things can be connected through a memory. So if you watched the cartoon or went to Disney World or whatever, if you have some memory of the sight and sound of Mickey Mouse, you can call that up as a singular memory because those neurons that are located in very different parts of your brain are neurologically connected. They're have an associated circuit that was bound together by the hippocampus. And so it can last, you know, decades and decades. I could see a cartoon of Mickey Mouse when I was five, and I can potentially still remember the sight and sound of that cartoon when I'm 90. And it's basically activating those neurons in different parts of my brain that have been forever connected.
We're speaking with Lisa Genova. I love that idea of forever connected. That is very heartening that some stuff is still in there and I just need to retrieve it. Her latest book is called Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. And I would love to hear from you how you mix the art and science of remembering by giving yourself a strategy to remember those things that our brains are just a bit too casual about, but we really need to know in our lives. You've got to make an appointment. You've got to pick something up. You've got to remember to take something out the door with you. How do you do that? Let's talk just briefly, Lisa, about the art of forgetting. Why is it important for us to be able to forget some things as well?
Right. So it's also just important to realize that forgetting is normal. So I think there's this misconception out there that there's sort of a war going on in your brain between memory and remembering, which is the good guy, and forgetting, which is the bad guy. And so whenever we forget something, we think, oh, my brain is failing. My memory is failing. And it's not, you know, we're not designed to remember everything. In fact, we're designed to remember what is meaningful, emotional, new, surprising. We're not designed to remember things that are the same old, routine, inconsequential. So if you think about the vast majority of your days, right, we actually don't remember most of our own lives. So we spend a lot of our lives doing routine, habitual things, right? We get up, we brush our teeth, we take the shower, drink the coffee, spend a lot of time on screens, you know, maybe commute the same commute. Like, it's very similar day to day. And we don't remember it. We don't retain it. So I can't remember what I had for dinner last Monday. And I can't remember the shower I took last Friday or the load of laundry I did, you know, 2 weeks ago. And that's okay. If we were burdened with remembering everything, if everything stayed and was in the foreground, it would actually be quite debilitating. There have been people throughout history who have retained everything all the time. And it's quite a handicap. So yes, it's important for us to remember what is meaningful, and we discard what isn't.
And you write about one of those people who trained himself to be able to shed some of that dross and forget it. How did he do it?
Right. His name was Solomon Sharevsky, and he was studied by a psychologist named Alexander Luria for decades. And so Solomon was known as the man who could not forget. And so you could give him massive quantities of text in a different language, and he would memorize it and then be able to recall it word for word decades later. He could memorize mathematical formulas he didn't understand and do the same thing. The problem was he couldn't pay attention to the conversations that mattered. There was too much information online, and he was very burdened by this. He would use imagery to try to get rid of what he didn't want anymore. So he would imagine what he was trying to forget as written in chalk on a chalkboard and then erased, or written on a piece of paper and then burned into flames. And so different imagery can work. This, you know, this is true for lots of people, right? If you want to forget the worst day of your life, and you keep perseverating and going over and over it in your thoughts, you know, the quickest way to stop remembering something, to forget something, is to stop replaying it, stop rehearsing it. Every time you rehearse the memory, you're strengthening it and making it stronger. This is super tough for folks who have PTSD, right? For post-traumatic stress disorder. There are ways that psychologists are working with those folks now to help them recall the memory without the painful emotional aspects, and then restore this newer, kinder, gentler version, or use visual imagery like Solomon and try to, you know, have it go up in flames.
Well, it seemed so unfair, though, Lisa, to read that, you know, retrieving a memory helps keep it fresh in your brain and maintain those physical neural connections so they don't just retract from each other. But also, every time you retrieve it, you're probably changing it and remembering it wrong. That seems such a sad catch-22.
Well, this is only true for the stuff that happened. So in terms of remembering the stuff you know, or muscle memory, those are very stable throughout your life and don't change every time you retrieve them. So if I know that George Washington was the first president of the United States, and I repeat this information and I tell it to my kids, I don't risk at any point that information changing to, oh, Abe Lincoln was the first president of the United States. Like, that's not going to happen. And once I learn to ride the bike, I know how to ride the bike. I'm not going to then get on it and then practice my tennis swing for some reason. So, but for the stuff that happened, it's strange. And you're right, it seems a little unfair, but there's actually probably a good evolutionary reason for it. So when we retrieve the stuff that happened, it's very vulnerable to editing and changing. So we think our memories for things that happened are reality. But in fact, the memory to begin with isn't reality, because we can only remember that slice of reality that captured our interest and bias to begin with, right? So if it's Christmas, if I'm remembering Christmas morning when I was 10, and I am remembering that, you know, I got skis and Aunt Susie was there that year. My brother, who was 12 at the time, and he wasn't close with Aunt Susie, might say, no, that you didn't get skis. Like, he doesn't remember the skis at all, but he doesn't. He's not a skier. He's a baseball player, and all he remembers is the new baseball mitt he got. And he doesn't remember Aunt Susie being there at all. So your memories for the same event can be totally different based on perspective. But then it can change over time, because every time you recall a memory for something that happened, you might add something new. You might leave something out. You may have seen something on the news that's related. Maybe it's 10 years later and you're a different person with a different political view, or you're in a different emotional state and you're much more positive today and you've learned some things. And so through that lens of wisdom, you can interpret what happened in a different way. Now what happens is you restore that memory, writes over the original. So it's like hitting save in Microsoft Word. The original memory will no longer exist. It's this new version that gets restored. So the next time you go to recall that memory, it's the newer version. And scientists have studied this up and down, and it's so fascinating. So for those flashbulb memories, those memories for events that we all sort of share. So in the U.S., a lot of people have this memory for where they were, who they were with, what they were doing, time of day, for when John F. Kennedy was killed, or when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, or when the Twin Towers collapsed in 9/11. And this doesn't have to be for a public event. It could be for some like personal, you know, shocking news, something that was shocking and emotional and personal. And so you think you remember these things exactly, but psychologists have asked folks, like, within 24 hours of the Space Shuttle Challenger blowing up, they asked college students, these are like 19 and 20 year olds, so people with young brains, you know, where were you? Who were you with? What was going on when the space shuttle blew up? They had these same students come back 2.5 years later and take the same questionnaire. 75% of them never remembered having done this in the first place. And none of the students gave answers that 100% matched their original. What's even more strange, which even stranger, is when shown their original answers in their own handwriting, these students were befuddled by that. They'd say things like, oh, well, that's strange, because that's not how I remember it. Mm. Like, they stick to the memory that they have now because that's what feels real. So memories for what happened are funny things. And, you know, it gets interesting when you think about things like eyewitness testimony, which are essentially memories for stuff that happened.
Yes, particularly if it's years and years after the event. We're speaking with Lisa Genova, author of her latest book, Remember, which is a real how-to for dealing with your memory. I learned a lot about how we remember and how we forget and how we don't need to forget, and how also we don't need to freak out so much when we do forget. Genevieve texted in saying, why do some people remember things that happened to both of you so differently? And I think we've just dealt with that. Lisa, I think that a lot of our listeners are going to want to know, okay, A, how do I train my memory to be better? And B, how do I stave off dementia later down the track? Let's start with that first one. What are some practical things we can do day to day to help our memory get better? Or is it okay to just cave and let technology deal with it?
Actually, there's some good overlap here. And also, I should mention, like, the cave and let technology do it. It is not cheating to Google a word that goes missing that's on the tip of your tongue. So if, especially for proper nouns, people's names, these live in neurological cul-de-sacs that are super hard to retrieve. And it's a normal byproduct of how our brains are designed that we can't remember names. And so you can suffer in a tip of the tongue, but you're not making your memory any stronger by doing so. So you don't have to be a memory martyr. You have my permission to Google it. Likewise, yeah. So this is good news for folks, right? They really worry, like, oh my gosh, I'm getting Alzheimer's because I cannot remember his name. No. Likewise, remembering what we plan to do later, it's called prospective memory. And we are universally terrible at this. Do not rely on your brain to remember to do something later. You want to externalize this. You want to write to-do lists, checklists, pill boxes, put what you need to bring with you by the front door, so you'd have to trip over it if you're going to leave the house. This is why airline pilots don't rely on their prospective memories to lower the wheels before landing the plane. Thankfully, they use a checklist. So what can you do to help protect your memories? So
sleep is really a primary one, and it's not very sexy, but it's the data is so compelling. We need 7 to 9 hours of sleep to consolidate the memories of whatever we learned and experienced today. And again, by consolidate, I mean really like locking it in, but really forming the memory. So the stuff that was meaningful, that you paid attention to, that was interesting, that you studied for today, if you want that to be a lasting memory that you can retrieve later, this happens while you sleep. This is when your hippocampus is busy at work. So if you deprive yourself of sleep, those memories may not be fully formed or may not be formed at all the next day. If you also, if you don't get a full night's sleep, you won't, your attention won't be really fully on board the next day, right? You're sluggish and you're having a hard time paying attention. Well, you now know that the number one first ingredient that you need to form a new memory is attention. So you're going to have trouble the next day forming new memories. And then the other major thing that happens with respect to memory while you sleep is that cells in your brain called glial cells, this is the sewage and sanitation department in your brain. They're the janitors. They clear away the metabolic debris that accumulated during the business of being awake. And one of the things it clears away is a protein called amyloid beta. Now, amyloid beta is a protein that if it piles up, it sticks to itself and forms plaques. And if too many plaques form, that's the beginning of Alzheimer's. So, again, you want to get a good night's sleep because you want to give the janitors enough time to clear away all of that amyloid beta so you don't wake up in the morning with amyloid beta still in your brain. So sleep is a preventative measure for Alzheimer's. So it's going to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's and it's going to improve your memory performance today. Stress is another big one. So a little bit of stress is actually good for memory, right? You can think of even performance with athletes. Again, any physical activity that you know the choreography for, that you've learned, that's a memory. So you need a certain amount of like alertness in your brain, which can be, you know, a little bit of stress to, give a presentation on your Zoom meeting, right? You want to be alert and awake and have a certain amount, but you don't want to be in overwhelm. So if you have too much stress, that's going to inhibit the retrieval of information you know. And I think maybe a lot of us have experienced that if we're taking a test and we've studied really hard and we know it, but we're so stressed when we show up, we draw a blank and we choke and we don't know any of the answers. The biggest thing with stress, though, it has to do with chronic stress. So stress is meant to come on and then go off. And evolutionarily, it was, you know, if you're being chased by a predator or an enemy, your body has to quickly mobilize to action, to fight or flee. And then once the danger or threat is over, everything calms down and goes back to normal. The problem with chronic stress is that it can break the shutoff valve and things don't go back to normal. And your body and your brain stay flooded with stress hormones, in particular cortisol. And cortisol is really bad for memory. And so we're not being chased by predators, you know, in the wild today, but our thoughts can be our predators, right? So, like, I think a lot of us, especially in the past year, have been under chronic stress with uncertainty and lack of control and social isolation. I mean, these are all major psychological stressors. And so when we have too much cortisol, that can actually shrink the size of your hippocampus. It will inhibit neurogenesis. You'll have less neurons in your hippocampus, which you know is a necessary structure for forming new memories. So you'll be foggy. And a lot of us have felt this, right? We're like our memories feel a little dull this year or lately.
So Lisa, it sounds like stress and sleep are two things to really get under control. I'm just aware we only have about half a minute left. What about those things like brain training and crosswords and things like that?
Yeah. Sorry, one sec. Meditation, yoga, those are your tools against stress. So sorry, what did you ask about crosswords?
I was just wondering, in our last 30 seconds or so, is it any good doing those brain training, crossword puzzles, Sudoku type of things?
Nope. So I don't know who started that. Don't do the crosswords. I mean, you can if you like them, but they're not improving your memory. The brain games, no data to show those help. What helps is learning new things. So listening to this radio program, reading a book and talking about it with your friends. Get out of your routine. Go for a walk in a new neighborhood. Learn an instrument. anything that's challenging your brain, you're creating new neural pathways, you're giving yourself a lot of cognitive reserve and building an Alzheimer's resistant brain.
That's what we all want. Lisa Genova, thank you so much for talking with us today. I've learned a lot.
Good. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Lisa Genova, author of Remember, among many, many other books, best-selling author and neuroscientist. You're listening to Life Matters.